Hey guys, it's Elena.
And it's Candace.
And you're listening to Cousins on Crime.
Happy Memorial Day weekend, everybody. It's over.
It's over.
But yeah. What'd you do?
I went to Galveston with my parents.
So you did make it despite the car trouble.
I did.
Okay.
Yes. Chris had just got his truck out of the shop, transmission issues.
I was going to say, didn't he just get it back?
Yeah. He had it a total of 28 hours.
Dios mío.
Yeah. And so we were going to take it to Galveston, a 5-hour journey, and we get an hour down the road and it starts jumping.
Oh man.
Worse than it did before.
Yikes.
So we took it back and they were like, oh, this is a defective transmission. Okay.
Wow.
So yeah, they only had one in stock, but they had to find it. I think it was like in Houston somewhere. So
goodness gracious.
Yeah. But hey, we didn't get 5 hours down the road and then have trouble. That's so good. There's positives.
Well, you're just a positive petunia, aren't you?
I really try.
So did you have fun at the beach?
It was a great time. There was the red flag warnings there.
And oh.
It was very windy. Mm-hmm. The waves were high. And the riptide was there. And actually, my dad and I were swimming, and Chris, we all were swimming in the ocean, and my dad starts feeling like he's getting swept away, but he was able to get out of the current. But actually, two people had drowned while we were there.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, it was very sad.
Oh no.
But
do you remember when we were kids and we almost got riptided away?
In the river, though.
In the river.
Yes, ma'am.
And we were rescued by, I believe it was a Little Mermaid towel that was thrown to
no,
us.
No, that towel almost drowned me. That was almost my
end. Well, I remember clutching a towel and being pulled to safety.
I'm pretty sure you brought that towel in the river with you.
Okay. Well, maybe, you know, details are fuzzy. Yeah. It was a traumatic experience.
It really was. I honestly thought I was going to die that day.
Yeah, I did too. I did too. But we would have gone together. How cute. Oh,
that would not have been cute for our family.
Would they have buried us together though? Like side by side?
Oh, I don't want to think about that.
Okay. Well, anyways, I'm just thinking like what if, because I have intrusive thoughts, you know?
Yeah.
Anyways.
Now I can't get my mind off of it.
Okay, on to the case.
Okay, so no more chit-chat.
No more chit-chat.
Actually, I do have a few questions for you. Did you hear about the ice cream truck that crashed?
No.
The driver blamed it on the rocky road.
I should have known.
Why didn't the ice cream sandwich like the popsicle?
I don't know.
Because the popsicle had a stick up her butt.
Lena, that was a little PG-13. I'm surprised at you.
Excuse me. Why was the ice cream cone misunderstood?
Why?
He was always waffling. I've got one more.
Okay, go ahead.
What did the lawyer say to the ice cream?
What did he say?
You got served.
I love those. Thank you for that.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's a reason I'm talking about ice cream today.
Okay. For our 100th episode?
Yeah.
Delicious. Mm-hmm. Did you guys notice? The 100 in front of this episode. Lena's about to serve
oh
you a delicious story.
'Tis so sweet.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's nothing sweet about murder, yeah, but I don't
think so.
Yeah. Thank you for listening to our 100th episode.
Yes.
Hope you love it.
I hope you love all the other episodes, but thanks for sticking around for 100 of them.
Yes. We will have a celebration. Maybe get some ice cream after this.
Ooh.
Okay. So, Candace, your sister and Chris and I, shout out Kennedy. We were playing a friendly game of Skip-Bo a couple weeks ago.
Mm-hmm.
When we heard the ice cream truck music outside.
Oh, man. Did you get a banana fudge bomb? That's my favorite.
I did not. This ice cream truck just started coming around our neighborhood. I've heard him like only 3 times. You already asked me, did I jump up and go get an ice cream? No, we didn't go get our Powder Puff ice cream or our Ninja Turtle. But it did prompt us to go get a Blizzard from Dairy Queen.
See, I can never make it to the ice cream truck. Like, I hear him, but by the time I can find cash or whatever and make it out the door, he's gone.
Yeah, you just have to run out and say, stop, I'll be right back.
Okay.
So
I do it all wrong. But at least you got your Blizzard. That sounds delicious.
So I highly recommend the Turtle Pecan Blizzard.
I'm going after this.
Yeah. It's 10 out of 10. So hearing that also started a conversation on can you track an ice cream truck to know when they're going to be in the area?
You should be able to.
Right?
That's a good idea.
So we looked some stuff up, and nowadays some trucks have GPS and apps that you can track them on.
That's so cool.
Yeah. Kids these days have it so easy, right?
I know.
Also, we wondered where ice cream trucks go when they're done for the day. Like, you don't just see them sitting in front of someone's house.
Yeah.
I'm sure some do park their trucks at their house, but Kennedy read that there are designated parking lots where ice cream trucks can go park.
Okay.
I don't know how true that is. But
can you tell me where that is?
I know. Do they leave the ice cream in the freezer? Then we got talking about safety and how creepy maybe some ice cream trucks or ice cream men can be. And I apologize for the stereotype. If you're listening and you are an ice cream man or know one personally, I mean, no disrespect. But Keeks and I both agreed that my next case should be about an ice cream truck driver. So here it is. January 2010, a 39-year-old Michael Keatley was driving his ice cream truck in Ruskin, Florida. A young woman flagged him down as he stopped, and this black female walked up to the truck and made a purchase. As this interaction was happening, 2 black males wearing masks approached. They get into the vehicle and robbed him of his $12. They shot him and ran away.
Oh my gosh.
I'm not trying to make this case about race. Mm-hmm. I'm sure you've noticed I said black people. But this information will be an interesting detail in the case.
Okay.
And I know what you're thinking. You thought I was going to tell you a story about a creepy ice cream man who was a ice cream man by day and a killer by
That's
night.
That's exactly what I thought you were going to say.
And here I am telling you about that he's a victim. But just keep listening. So Michael sustained several injuries due to being shot a total of like 5 times.
Oh my goodness.
He was shot in the leg. And his bones in his right hand and right forearm were shattered.
Oh.
This limited the use of his right hand. And he tried to grab his cell phone to call police. But he found it easier to climb into the driver's seat. He couldn't grip his phone. He got into the driver's seat and drove away. As he got down the road, he saw a woman who was one of his regular customers. He stopped next to her and asked her for help. She was able to call for an ambulance for him, and Michael survived. He was in the hospital and went through therapy and treatment for quite a while. He was able to report to the police what had occurred. The local news station interviewed Michael as he was recovering at home, and he pleaded on camera for anyone with information to come forward. Crime Stoppers had offered a reward. Local gas stations and stores set up donation jars for Michael.
I bet. A beloved ice cream man. Yeah. Just doing the Lord's work.
Right. Police were not able to identify or arrest any suspect in the case.
Wow.
Michael grew more and more impatient. He was not happy with law enforcement. He felt that they were not doing their job fast enough. He did not have insurance, and his medical bills were growing. So he was looking for justice.
Yeah. Can imagine.
By November 2010, 11 months, he was in full obsession on trying to solve his case on his own. Michael had conducted his own investigation. He went and talked to people in the neighborhood. He researched any and all tips on the internet. He bought a firearm for protection. Mm. One of the tips that he received was that the people responsible for shooting and robbing him was actually Hispanic. So not Black, like he said he saw with his own eyes and reported to the police.
Did this tip say why?
No.
They were Hispanic and not Black?
No, it was just word on the street.
Okay.
So sounds like Michael was waffling, like that ice cream cone.
Yes.
Yeah. The rumor was that the name of the person who did this to him was Creeper. Now, Creeper's real name was Omar Bayon. Michael told his girlfriend and other friends to be on the lookout for this man called Creeper, a man with a tattoo of the word Creeper tattooed on his arm. He got the address of where Creeper lived at 507 Ocean Mist Court. Norma Jean Towers, a friend of Michael's, was asked to drive by Creeper's home and through the neighborhood looking at license plates. She drives and he looks and writes down all the notes, taking it all in. Michael also put a notice on his ice cream truck that he was offering a reward to help him find Creeper. But he also told everyone that he knew that if they saw Creeper, to call him, not the police.
Okay.
Because they don't do their job, is what he thought.
Right.
He also questioned a 13-year-old girl and made her cry, like interrogated her.
Oh, that's not good.
He hired his friend, David Beckwith, to be his backup on the ice cream truck. Since he had limited use of his hand, Michael would stay in the driver's seat while David would go in the back to the back window and make the sale.
And I'm sure he didn't want to be alone.
Exactly.
After being attacked.
Exactly. I wouldn't either.
No, I wouldn't either.
So they would split the day's profit 50-50. Another reason to have David along was for an extra pair of eyes to help him look for Creeper. Watch for a man with that tattoo.
Mm-hmm.
Michael's robbery case was still open, and so Michael would give law enforcement all of the leads that he was getting, but he was never really able to tell him how he got those leads, like you had asked.
Yeah.
So it wasn't ever any concrete evidence, like who told him or where did he get it? So police didn't really know what to think, since they now have this conflicting information about the ethnicity of the robbers.
Mm-hmm.
In a review of Michael's internet searches, it showed that he looked up the word law enforcement 22 times. He looked up Ocean Mist 92 times.
Oh my.
He looked up Glock firearm 2,353 times.
Oh my goodness.
He looked up the word uniform 3,996 times. He looked up Omar Bayon's name 11,602 times. So, yes, he was in full obsession.
Wow.
He wanted revenge. On November 24th of 2010, the Wednesday night before Thanksgiving that year, there was a group of friends and family hanging out. There at the party was Juan Guitron, who was 28, Sergio Guitron, who was 22, Richard Cantu, 31, Ramon Galan, 29 years old, Gonzalo Guevara, 28, Daniel Beltran, 24 years old, and Jose Rodriguez. And I'm sorry, Jose, I did not find your age, but this is their age in 2010.
Okay.
They were hanging out on the front porch at 604 Ocean Mist Court.
Not the right address.
Correct. But it's a group of Hispanics.
I mean,
Creeper has to be there, right?
Yeah.
They were playing card games and drinking, and a few of them were using marijuana and cocaine.
All right.
They were all off the next day for the Thanksgiving holiday. At around 2 a.m., they see a dark-colored minivan drive down the street. And then the van turns and comes back towards the house that they were at. The van comes to a stop and parks at the end of the driveway. A white man gets out, and he's wearing a black shirt, and in white letters it said sheriff.
Oh.
He's wearing dark green camo pants. The man has a gun in his hand. He approached the porch where the group of friends were, where they were playing cards, and says, "Where's Creeper? Who's Creeper? Which one of you is Creeper?" Well, Omar Bayon, a.k.a. Creeper, was not there with them.
Yeah.
This man, later identified as Michael Keatley, demanded that each of them show him their ID cards. Thinking that he was law enforcement, they complied.
Yeah.
He told them all to get down on the ground. They complied and got down on their knees, pulling out their ID cards, holding them up in the air. Well, Michael proceeded to shoot. Execution style, he killed them.
All of them?
I will tell you.
Oh, my Lord.
A couple of them got away. So I will tell you what was the story that unfolded. One of the victims was able to give
the account. Wow.
Right. So when the first friend was shot, the others were realizing that this man was not actually law enforcement.
Well, I'll say. Yeah.
A couple of them were able to flee. Jose Rodriguez, he ran and got away without a shot.
Wow.
Daniel Beltran was shot several times in the hip, the chest, and he was grazed on his face. He was able to get away and survive.
Wow.
It all happened so fast.
Yeah.
Daniel would later testify that he still believed the man was law enforcement. As he's trying to get away. Wow. Even after the first shots were fired, hitting Juan, he said Juan refused to get on the ground. And he was telling the man, to the gunman, just like, chill out.
Yeah. Like, stop shooting my friends.
Yeah.
Chill.
Yeah, chill. We're getting your IDs. But, and that's when the gunman started shooting him. Oh, so Daniel thought he would... The gunman was just mad because Juan was denying him.
Mm-hmm.
So Daniel said, "I heard one gunshot and I didn't want to turn around. And then I heard two more shots and I still didn't want to turn around. And then I heard him walking behind me and getting closer." He says he finally turned and looked and saw the man put the gun to Richard Cantu's head. He says at that point, he tried to fight back with an empty beer bottle. He like grabbed the bottle and smack him. But he grabbed it, tried to hit him with the beer bottle, and the gunman, Michael Keatley, saw Daniel moving, and that's when he shot Daniel in the hip. Daniel said, "I was just moving everywhere." He was explaining that he kept moving to avoid being shot.
Mm-hmm.
It's harder to hit a moving target.
Exactly.
As he was crawling away, he said the gunman shot toward him but missed, hitting the window. The man then came closer and shot him in the chest, causing him to fall off the porch. The gunman looked over the railings to see if Daniel was dead or alive. And Daniel just, he kept crawling away. He's like, wow, trying to get out of there. And that's when he was shot in the back. And then another shot, that shot grazed his ear. Wow. Daniel kept dragging himself. He dragged himself toward the back of the house where he spotted a metal fence with a chair in front of it. He crawled up on the chair, threw his leg over the fence, and plopped on the other side. Meanwhile, he can still hear gunfire in the background.
Oh, my Lord.
And he still believed the shooter was coming for him. He tried to stay quiet in the bushes. He remembered he had a cell phone in his pocket. And so he called police and then he called his ex-wife. He's like, please come and get me. He told her exactly where he was.
Oh my goodness.
He saw her come down the street, the headlights coming down. So he's like trying to peek his head up so she could see him. So yeah, Juan was shot twice in the back and Sergio was shot once in the back. Both brothers died from their gunshot wounds.
Oh no.
Sergio was pronounced dead at the scene, and the rest of them were taken to the hospital. Juan was eventually pronounced deceased at the hospital, so them two died and everyone else survived.
Wow.
Richard Cantu, he was shot in the back of the head, and he survived with no memory of the event.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah. I mean, he's still on the left side from the back of his head. It came out the front. And he has the scars. He suffered brain damage as a result of his injuries, and he's had to relearn how to walk and talk. Ramon Galan was shot on the right side of his body, and it exited out of the other side of his body. Gonzalo Guevara was shot, I think, a total of 4 times in the back.
Mm.
Amazing that those, that they all survived.
Wow.
So to tell you a little bit about the two that were killed, Paz Quezada, Sergio and Juan Guitron's mother, said that she and her sons were inseparable.
Oh, no.
Especially after the death of their father just a few years earlier.
I cannot.
I know.
Even.
Bless her heart.
Ugh.
After their father's funeral, the three of them held hands and made a pact to be united always.
Oh my gosh.
She says, the three of us were like one person.
Oh.
Sergio and Juan still lived at home with their mother, and they liked to have friends over and their cousins over, and they would have cookouts. Sergio loved to cook and grill out. On Mother's Day, they would send their mother flowers to her job.
Aww.
They were also responsible and hardworking. Sergio worked for a medical parts company, and Juan worked for a sofa company. They were loved by everyone.
Mm.
Detectives got down to business and started looking for clues and evidence, piecing it all together. They found the .45 caliber shell casings, wallets, driver's licenses that were pulled from their wallets. They started interviewing family and neighbors. The surviving victims were able to give a really good description of the person and the vehicle used by the gunman. They told detectives that the gunman asked about Creeper. So now they have to figure out what was the motive behind finding Creeper.
Right.
Stacy Rogan, the ex-girlfriend of Michael Keeley, called police the day after Thanksgiving after she heard the news report that several Hispanic males were gunned down on Ocean Mist Court. She calls police and tells them that she thinks she knows who did this and explains that her ex-boyfriend had an obsession with finding Creeper because he thinks he's the one that robbed him 11 months prior.
Yeah.
So on November 27th, Michael is brought in for questioning. They ask him if he thinks Creeper. They're like, do you think Creeper's responsible for your robbery? And Michael says, no.
Hmm.
They asked, have you ever asked anyone about a man named Creeper? Michael says, no. So ultimately, he was arrested for 2 counts of first degree murder and 4 counts of attempted murder, and he was denied bail. On the 28th, detectives go and search Michael's home and property. Michael had several guns, including a .45 caliber shell casings, lying on the ground around his home where he would shoot, have target practice.
Okay.
The casings were also found in a burn pit on his property.
Wow.
Multiple guns that use .45 caliber were recovered except for the Glock 21 that they were looking for.
Right.
His laptop was taken, as well as a notebook with Omar Bayon's name and address written on it. Fingerprints were taken from the notebook and tested, and was a match to Michael. Michael and his neighbor, Mr. Smith, had become buddies, and they had bonded over guns. Mr. Smith would go to Michael's property and have target practice, and Mr. Smith told detectives that Michael had asked about modification kits and attachments to put on his Glock 21. Also, during those times, just a few weeks before the murders, Michael would shoot a Glock 21 and even let Mr. Smith shoot it as well. So Mr. Smith is telling...
He had it.
Yeah, he's got a Glock 21, but where is it?
Yeah.
They had several guns, but that one is still not there. And actually, that Glock 21 was never recovered.
Wow.
But it's okay. They had the shell casings from Michael's property, and they did ballistics testing with the casings from the crime scene. And it was determined that those casings were all fired from the same gun.
Mm-hmm.
Also, all of the victims said that the gun used was a long gun. Like it was a handgun, but with like a longer barrel.
So modified, maybe?
Yeah, they said it was like a pump action gun, like the gun was modified,
right.
Which would make sense because that's part of the defense is Michael couldn't have done this because of his limited use of his hand.
Uh-huh.
But if it's modified where he can easily do it.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, Michael also had multiple searches for aftermarket barrels for Glock 21. So, I mean, it was adding up.
Yeah. Sounds legit.
Right. And as if they needed more, David Beckwith, his ride-along partner, testified that Michael did normally carry 3 guns in the vehicle with them. David would have Michael's .45 caliber Glock 21 right there with him in the back by the back window, and Michael would have a .380 and a .22 caliber close to the front seat with him.
Goodness gracious, that's a little much.
Mm-hmm. David was a convicted felon himself. So he wasn't supposed to be in possession of guns. Apparently, Michael was in trouble with the law as well.
Uh-oh.
Before the January robbery, Michael had an altercation with his girlfriend's neighbors. He was also in trouble with the law because he had made threats to a fellow ice cream truck driver. He told her that if she kept selling ice cream in his territory, that he was going to burn her vehicle.
Oh, my.
He wasn't.
Wasn't a nice, nice old ice cream truck man.
So anyway, David, he also testified in court that Michael's plans were to take Creeper and his accomplices captive, take them to the Florida swamp, chain them to a tree, and let the alligators have their way with them.
Wow.
He also told investigators that one day Michael was demanding that David go to this guy's house, a particular guy with, he's like saying, you're going to go with me, to interrogate this guy to get more information about Creeper. Well, David said, no, I'm not. he's like, I'm not going to do it. While arguing about it, David pulled the gun on Michael. David's like, you're not going to make me do this or I'll shoot you. So he pulls the gun on Michael. He gets out of the ice cream truck, throws the gun through the window back into the truck, and just walks away.
Yikes.
David also said that another plan that Michael talked about was to dress like a police officer and approach and kill them. Sounds like that's the one he went with.
Right.
The day after the shootings, Michael took the dark colored minivan, which belonged to his father, by the way, and had it painted from the dark blue color that it was into a two-tone color, navy on top and tan on the bottom.
Why? Okay.
I don't know. Like, if you're going to go through that trouble, wouldn't you do like
red or like just a solid color to maybe
white? Something different than blue.
And also, two-tone is like more, what's the sketchy word I'm looking for? Well, it is like creepy, but it's also like more
noticeable.
Noticeable. That's the word. Why can't I think of that word?
Yeah.
Words are tough.
It is. It's not even late. We'll pretend it's late. He even stayed and helped the man painting the van. So,
all right.
Yeah, he's like, I'll help you with the process so it gets done faster.
Sure.
They worked into the night, even into the next morning, trying to get the paint job done quickly. One thing about this case that got me like right in the heart right here was that one of Michael Keatley's victims was aware of who Michael was and what happened to him in January. He had seen the donation jars at the gas stations and even donated money to help Michael.
Oh.
That's so, like, it just hurts my heart. These were kind, good people.
Yeah.
So, I mean, do you see what hate can do to a person?
Yeah.
Michael was so blinded by hate that he couldn't see the blessings and the positive around him.
Mm-hmm. The fact that he survived.
Right.
Yeah.
The craving for revenge was eating him up inside and hate took over him. Michael would spend a whopping 12 years in the local jail before he even got a trial.
What?
12 years.
Why?
Yeah. Well, for one, this was a capital crime. They had to follow certain protocol to ensure a fair trial, which meant he had to have a lead attorney and then a secondary attorney.
All right.
Other rules going on with that, but I didn't take the time to learn about them. But another reason is that in the beginning, Michael chose attorney Paul Carr and Leanne Gowdy to represent him. In the 12 years, there would be changes with his attorneys. Leanne Gowdy stayed on his case, but Paul Carr would ultimately be taken off the case due to a wreck that he had. He was in a car wreck, and he submitted this motion to the court to have him taken off because he had a concussion. He said he wouldn't be good at helping with the case.
Right.
So then another attorney was hired to help Leanne Gowdy. So a lot of drama with that.
Yeah, I understand that the wheels of justice turn slowly, but 12 years?
Yeah.
Wow.
Seems like, I mean, yes, 12 years can go by super fast, but it's a long time.
Yeah, that is a long time.
So within the 12 years of waiting, laws would be changed and bills would be passed. Initially, Michael would be facing the death penalty. Then a bill was passed taking the death penalty off the table and only allowing life imprisonment.
Okay.
Then it changed back. A new bill was signed allowing the death penalty to be back on the table.
Oh, my goodness. This is Kenneth McDuff all over again.
Oh, yeah. So he went through trial, and I guess his team did their job because the jury could not come up with a unanimous decision on a guilty verdict. So they declared a mistrial.
But how? How, like, what's your holdup there? I mean, if the case was presented in the way you've presented it here.
Right.
what's the question? Like, what's the issue you're stuck on?
So the main defense that they had was Michael couldn't have done this. He doesn't have use of his right hand, which was his dominant.
Well, maybe he was using his left hand, which is why he was a terrible shot.
Mm.
It seems to me that if a bunch of men were sitting on a porch, mm-hmm. you could probably pick them off pretty easily.
Yeah.
If you walk up to them.
Right. But you're standing close range.
The shoulder, the hip, the back. And
right.
You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Like, it seems like he could have just killed them all really easily.
Yeah.
Having been standing there right in front of them.
I don't know. But that was their biggest defense, was that he just couldn't have done it. And so that raised doubt in some of the jurors. I think it was 2-2.
What about the target practice? Why is he doing a bunch of target practice if he can't shoot a gun?
Right. I mean, he has plenty of witnesses saying that he was shooting the gun.
Put me on the stand.
I don't know. I didn't look up all of like the reasons why, mm-hmm. but that was the main defense. So after this mistrial, then COVID made its debut.
The C word.
Mm-hmm. Finally, in March 2023, a new trial began. The defense said that the survivors of the shooting identified the wrong man.
Oh, my.
And that Michael was not capable. Here we are. He was not capable of committing the attack because of the injuries he sustained when he was shot and robbed months earlier. The attorney said Michael is not guilty because he did not do it. Michael did not do it. He could not do it. And he was not medically capable. Like, I'm tired of hearing that. Yeah. That's the dumbest thing.
Yeah, that's pretty dumb.
But this time he was found guilty on all counts.
Good.
During the whole trial, Michael would sit quietly wearing a button-down dress shirt with a cardigan buttoned over it. He would sit there mostly blank-faced. Sometimes he would rest his chin on his hand as if he was just unbothered. Mm. At times, he would raise his eyebrows like, no. He would even shake his head when he didn't like something that mm-hmm. was said. Even still, I felt like I could read what he was thinking.
Yeah.
As the guilty verdict was announced, Michael could be seen mouthing something and subtly shaking his head in disbelief.
Wow.
I wish I could have read his lips, but yeah. I tried, but I couldn't. At the sentencing hearing, some of the surviving victims and family members were able to give statements. Gonzalo Guevara got up and told Michael that he was a coward and that he hurt so many people.
Yeah.
He told Michael that he can't forgive him. And that he took two really good people out of this world. Two people that were doing the right things.
Yeah.
Daniel Beltran, he got up and told Michael that he does forgive him. Because he knows that it was the devil in him.
Mm.
He told Michael that he should let go of that and ask God to forgive him. He said, "You aren't going to escape God's wrath, but..." He encouraged him to ask for forgiveness so that he could live a better eternal life. He said, "If you don't, you're going straight to hell." The judge sentenced him to life imprisonment on all 6 counts. The judge stated that in the state of Florida, life means life because there is no possibility of parole.
Hmm.
So, yeah.
Well,
I guess you could say he got served.
Oh.
And I don't mean soft served.
He got hard served. You know, there's like a missing piece from this. Like, who robbed him?
Exactly.
And not that I care really, because like, but it's the catalyst for this, right?
Right.
It seems like this was the beginning of the end for him.
Right.
He latched on to justice and he spiraled out of control.
Yeah.
It's a wonder, like, what if that never happened to him?
Right. I mean, yeah, there were times where he was in trouble with the law, but I mean, to do something
right
to this extent.
It's sad. I mean, it's sad. It's a sad story for the victims.
Yeah.
And it makes me sad that in, how old was he?
At the time he was 39. So when he was sentenced, I believe he was like 52.
It's sad that he didn't get the justice he felt like he needed, but that is no excuse.
I know.
For taking it as far as he did.
Yeah. I mean,
down the road that he did.
That's what happens when you let hate fester. I mean, it just festered.
It's cancerous.
Yes.
Well, that was great. Let's do it again sometime.
Okay. We'll do it next week.
All right. See you next week, guys.
Bye, y'all.
Bye now. Thank you for listening to Cousins on Crime. If you're enjoying our podcast, please consider leaving us a positive review and rating. To make sure you never miss an episode, subscribe to our show.
You can also follow us on Instagram at Cousins on Crime Podcast or send case suggestions to cousinsoncrime@gmail.com.